Hey, welcome to the Have a Sub podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Martinez. Today we have a special guest, Mr. Josh Balin. I feel like whenever I say Mr., it feels like I'm a kid again. Like, oh, Mr. or Mrs.
Yeah. Hey, I'm only 43 years old, so like I don't really go by Mr. yet.
Mr. I don't even know why I said Mr. This is fun. This is why I do this. So you never know what's going to happen. But Josh, where are you from? What part of the country are you from? Let's start off there.
So yeah, my name is Jason Balin from Hard Money Bankers. In the Washington D.C. Baltimore area, born and raised here. Moved out a little bit for college and to see Colorado and some other places of the country. You know, in my early 20s, and then ventured back here because I had an entrepreneurial spirit and, you know, had, you know, boots on the ground and knew people here locally that I didn't have connections and relationships with in other parts of the country. And, you know, dabbled around in lots of different areas of real estate early on, real estate agent, mortgage broker, flipping houses, buying rental properties, things like that. And, you know, eventually settled, and I use the word settled, which isn't probably the right word because that seems like, hey, you're just going to settle for something. But I was ambitious to start and grow Hard Money Bankers, which is a private lending company focusing on doing loans for real estate investors and commercial property owners in 2007. And yeah, you know, fast forward 16, 17 years, we're still thriving and growing and, you know, kind of doing good business and met a lot of great real estate investors and business owners along the way.
So my brother lives in Dumfries, so I've been over there a few times in that area. Yep. It is crazy, the traffic there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm north. So, you know, Dumfries is a suburb of Washington, D.C. In Virginia, and it's south of Washington, D.C. I'm north of Washington, D.C., between D.C. and Baltimore, kind of smack into the middle. So I actually, you know, both of those are pretty major markets and they somewhat blend together, but I'm in a county called Howard County, which my office is in, which I try not to leave if I don't need to. And yeah. I don't have, you know, there's not a lot of traffic. There's not as much congestion and makes my life a little bit easier.
There you go. One thing I love about this is you've been doing this for a very, very long time.
Absolutely. Very long time.
So you started in 2007, that we said?
Yep. We closed our first loan through our private lending company in 07.
Wow.
Right at the bottom. Right at the bottom of the market. Kind of right where it was like all going down and you weren't really sure. I mean, the bottom was probably 08, but you never know when the top and the bottom, you never know where you are in the market. So that's in hindsight, I kind of saw that.
So I have some early on questions because I just interviewed a guy last week and he killed it, literally killed it during 08 to 12. Time period. Was that like a huge acceleration point for yourself during that time as far as business goes?
So it's a good question and not really. And the reason why is you know, you don't know what you don't know in real time. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really have any of our own capital when we started our lending company. And you know,
we all started with nothing.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny to say that. It's like, how do you start a lending company? You don't have any of your own capital. So we were, you know, out there raising capital. We were out there looking for deals to lend on a regular basis. And we talk about this all the time. Like if there's a time in the market and we're able to see it and it's similar to those times, I believe we could absolutely kill it and accelerate, you know, with our own capital that we control, just resources that we have today. But I didn't have those back then. And we were very, very cautious. You know, if anyone's, you know, watching or listening, who's ever raised capital, like you're, especially early on, like you're terrified to potentially mismanage or lose that capital. Absolutely. And that's kind of how we were early on. So, you know, we look back at deals that we potentially passed on that, you know, 10x'd in value in the last 15 years. And, you know, that might sound extreme, but there's some areas of the country that that's happened to, especially in some areas around here. And that is, you know, that just is what it is. Like we were very, very cautious. And, you know, we didn't even have like a late payment for the first 4 or 5 years because we were just, we didn't know. We tried to write the best of the best deals, but I think it gave us a really good basis to start with. But yes, it was, the good part about starting back then was, you know, the stock market had just crashed. So when we were raising capital from, you know, high net worth individuals and things like that, you know, they wanted an alternative than to put their money in the market. And you know, there was no really private capital out there besides just kind of mom and pop. There's no institutional capital out there. Banks weren't really lending. So we did really have the upper hand to do so. So yeah. It did make it a little bit easier that, like, this is what our terms are. I mean, back then, pricing's 15%, 5 points, you know, which is a lot. Who knows? Maybe it goes back to that in the future as rates, if rates continue to go up. But they're, you know, it's gone down since that with pricing. So there was definitely some pros from doing that, but I think just like any time, it's always a good time to start, and there's always advantages and disadvantages of every market.
So, and I really want to dig in on that. A lot of people are like, I think some people, there's like the opposite side. Like, you have people that are too scared to jump in, and you have the people who are like, I'll figure it out. Like running through the front lines type person. Yeah. And I think when you first start, I think it's one of those things where, like, you have to be cautious. And I can understand being protective of your little investment capital that you had at the time. You got to be a steward of that, a fiduciary of that. I think it's as you grow, you kind of let go of that. Not that you're not as cautious, but you kind of let go of, like, hey, I'm doing good things. I know what I'm doing. Let me kind of release some pressure, because the pressure is immense.
No doubt.
So let's talk about raising private capital. I think you have an advantage because you've done this through multiple different swings. So let's talk about raising capital in terrible markets versus good markets, and what the difference is like, and what terms are they requiring? Because I think you've done both. So
absolutely. So going back real quick to what you said earlier, like, we just call that internally the education versus execution phase, like the seesaw. Okay. Like, and I think I know, you know where I'm getting at with that, but like, some people are just so educated, but they'll never get off, you'll never do a deal. And other people just want to go out and execute, but then they are really dangerous because they don't know what the hell they're doing, and they can, you know, lose houses, lose people's money, stuff like that. But anyways, related to raising capital. So, you know, here's the interesting part about raising capital is usually everyone thinks they just have to go out and they're scared to go find a deal until they have the capital lined up. Like, and I get it. It makes sense. And we were like that as well. You know, we came from, my business partner, Chris Haddon, and I came from like a mortgage background, and we had some real estate, or we were investing in some real estate. We weren't all that good at it, but like, we knew real estate investors and things. So like, we were like, we have deals. Like, we know people that want capital. Everyone needs capital. We just don't have any, we don't even have any of the capital. So, you know, surprisingly, when we went out and we chatted with, and none of the money early on came from really family or direct friends. They came from like a friend of a friend or a friend of a colleague or something like that. That's usually where it would start with. And, you know, again, we were in like our mid to late 20s at this time, you know, didn't exactly know how to raise capital. But what ended up happening is everyone we talked to, in essence, was like, yeah, I mean, that made sense. It makes sense. You're willing to give me a high rate of return, you know, a double digit interest rate of return. I'm potentially collateralized by a first position and a first mortgage on investment real estate. I don't want to say it was like 100% closing ratio, but verbally it was pretty high, because everyone's like, yeah, like, that's a no brainer. Like, who wouldn't do that type of deal? Right. Yeah. Go find me the deal. And we're like, okay. And then when we actually went to go look for deals that we thought were going to be easy to find, they really weren't, right? I mean, that doesn't mean that there wasn't, like, you know, potential borrowers out there that were looking for, you know, high leverage and cheap terms and didn't have good credit. Like, just because somebody wants capital doesn't mean you're going to give it to them, right? Just because a seller wants to sell you a property doesn't mean that you're going to want to buy it, right? So like, we learned that we had to weed through tons and tons and tons of deals and opportunities before we can find the good ones. But then as we found the good ones, we realized that the capital is very, very easy to use, because like, we, you know, a month later, we go back to that capital investor and say, hey, so I found this deal. The borrower is buying it for $100,000 and needs $50,000 in renovations. It's going to be worth, you know, whatever, $200,000, call it. And we're going to lend this amount of money, and they're going to, you know, we were really cautious. Like I was saying early on, we were really cautious on stuff. We're going to lend, you know, $100,000 with $50,000 held back. So the borrower is going to need to bring $50,000 to the table plus closing costs, which sounds crazy, right? But like, you know, again, you want to do the best of the best deals, especially early on, to get some traction. And they were like, yeah, this is a no-brainer. Like, why don't they just go to the bank? And our answers were like, well, banks aren't really lending to real estate investors currently. Like, they're just not. And that's what was going on at that time. So we created a track record of finding really, really good opportunities. And I'm like a big advocate of anyone who has a good deal, like a really, really good deal. Like you should never have the problem. You should never have a hard time getting the capital for that deal. It might not be at the terms that you necessarily want, but like the capital is available between private money and hard money and banks and HELOCs and JV partnerships and things like that. And I mean, I look at deals all day long and, you know, someone might not want to pay us 13% interest rate in 3 points. And I get it. Like that might not work, but like that is an option, right? There's always different capital out there. So we, you know, again, what we ended up building and it stays like this today is just in essence, like a front end marketing machine to just try to get as many opportunities as we can and, you know, find the best of the best of the best of the best deals, knowing that like, if you do a bad deal, there's so much stuff that can go wrong, right? The deal goes bad. Potentially it's a headache. You gotta, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a loan or a purchase and you're buying it yourself. It doesn't really matter. If you do it, it goes headache and you go, you know, goes over budget, then you got to put some more money in, then you got to do this. Then you, you know, and that's all just like on the front end, that doesn't include your capital investors. You know, if you're raising capital behind that, then all of a sudden, like on a lender, so let's say I'm acting as the lender, I got to go foreclose on the property, but then I got a capital investor on the back end who's pissed off because they're not getting monthly payments. And then potentially they might even want to try to sue me because they might not get their money back. So like, it's hard enough to default, you know, a deal on the front end, then you got to deal with a capital investor and then they tell their friends and then it's a small niche community and then you're out of business. So like it all stems from having a good deal on the front end to be able to put different capital sources in your capital stack on the back end. And I don't think it's just for a lending company. I think that's for an operator as well, right? Like you buy your first fix and flip and you lose money and potentially like you have a capital investor who's like, hey, what's going on with this? Why haven't you given me my return? You know, and then they realize a loss, you'll probably just be out of the business. You'll probably just give up. Be like, this sucked. Like this was a lot of pressure. I couldn't sleep at night. So all of it stems from a good opportunity on the front end.
So I want to break down a couple of things. So I like this conversation. I like this direction because a lot of wholesalers and a lot of buyers don't understand the lender's responsibility and the lender's role in the transaction. And we have and carry our own liability whenever we're bringing private capital into a transaction. So it has to, and I tell students all the time, like you have to find and negotiate better deals because we if we're bringing the capital, have to protect our lenders. We have to. That's the bottom line. Like, I don't care what your assignment fee is. We have to protect the lender's capital. That's paramount on every transaction.
Absolutely.
So it's one of those things where a lot of wholesalers don't understand that, especially if they're new. They don't understand the capital stack and buying at good margins and what is real margin of safety. And I think it's great that you're early on, you were asking for a large down payment. I mean, people 50 cent, if you're 50 cents in the dollar loan to value, I mean, you're doing all right in a great position if you ever have to default and clean up that mess.
Yeah. And it might not work for people and I get it, but like, you know, you got to start somewhere. I mean, everyone will do the best deals that they have in front of them at any given time, right? If I show you 10 deals, you're going to pick the number one deal out of all of them to do. But if I show you 100 deals or 1,000 deals, chances are you're probably going to have a better deal that you can choose from. And that's why it's all about the front end marketing machine. Like I look at thousands, you know, between myself and I have partners that run some other local offices for us. Like we're looking at thousands of deals a month to close 25 of them collectively. You know, I know lenders across the country. And I know real estate investors across the country that like look at a few deals and they're picking one of them to do. So again, that's not to mean that like, And let's be honest, if you do a bad deal, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not going to work out. Like looking back, I've done deals that we've scraped by that we've been able to, you know, the market's helped over the last 10 years. That's one thing, you know, as an operator, you know, we've got lucky on some stuff, you know, we've purchased properties and we ended up making more money than we expected. Or, you know, we're like, oh my God, this thing's crappy. And we just scraped out. So like, just because you don't do a good deal doesn't mean like the point is to do good deals, but also as you grow as a business owner and real estate investor and entrepreneur is you got to get better at it, right? I think the worst thing that every person that made money in real estate over the last 5, 8, 10 years have done is doing skinny margin, marginal deals, and the market's continuing to grow up and they've been making money that way, and they actually don't even have a business and they don't even know really what they're doing, because it's like, oh, I just went on MLS and I found a deal and I flipped it. I made money. And it's like, you're all out of business now, because like that stuff is hard. That stuff, not that it doesn't exist, but it's hard to do as things change. So, you know, I look at it as, hey, if a good thing's going, learn from it and make it better and better and better and better. And again, like I got lucky on early on deals, because even if I was super conservative, the market still helped, right? Like if a property's worth 100 today and worth $200,000 tomorrow, you could completely shit the bed. You can completely, you know, screw up on construction. Your contractors can steal from you and you'll still make money on the deal. But you got to use that as a learning tool.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you more of a underwrite the deal versus the person, or you kind of weigh them equally?
So everything we do internally, we follow this to a T. 4 C's, collateral being top priority, collateral being most important, and then character being the second most important. And then capacity, you know, they have the ability to do the deal, and then credit, you know, so they all are an intricate part, but it's definitely a piece of collateral that we're comfortable lending on. And again, like credit is in there, but it's not the most important thing. I want to make sure the borrower has good character and has the ability to do that, because I'll tell you from experience over and over and over, a crappy character borrower will bring down a good deal at any time. And I could give and someone could do a real marginal, not great deal, but they have great character and they'll figure out a way to make it work and they'll figure out a way to pay us back. So on a lending side, that's super important.
So collateral, character, and
capacity.
Capacity.
Yeah, capacity, then credit. So like, do they have down payment money? Do they have the ability to do a construction project? If it's your first project, it's kind of hard to do a $165,000 construction project in like a major city where the buildings were built in the 40s or the 50s, because there's so many unknowns. You don't have the resources. You don't have the permits. In Washington, D.C., it could take you 12 months to get a permit, right? So if there's a newbie real estate investor that, you know, has a good deal, they have good character, they have a lot of cash they're willing to put into the deal, that still might not be the best fit for them at this time, just because they don't have the resources. They don't have an expediter that can help push permits through the city. You just don't know what you don't know. You know, a deal that might be in the suburbs where it's like a lipstick on a pig project, or, you know, something that's a little bit more manageable, you know, might be right for them. And, you know, on that topic, I know there was a time, and this still might happen, that a lot of like the institutional capital of the world, the institutional hard money lenders, they wouldn't lend to first time real estate investors, or they had to do like a certain amount of fix and flips. Yep. And I kind of thought that was ridiculous. And the reason why is like some of our best borrowers ever have always been first time real estate investors, because they're so vested on succeeding. Now, again, it's got to be the right person. Right. It can't just be like, oh, I'm looking for 100% finance and I don't want to put any money into the deal and I got crappy credit, but I found this deal on MLS. But not that. I'm talking about, you know, they have a corporate job, or if they live in the DC area, they have a government job, you know. Yeah. And which is common. Exactly. They're hungry. They went through, you know, an expensive training program that they paid for, you know, bus tours, training programs, coaching, consulting. They've done that. They've already done all their due diligence. It's just a matter of finding a good deal. A lot of the times their deals aren't great, right? Because they're new and they're not great. Like they don't, you know, they haven't put in like 10,000 hours of door knocking and cold calling and bandit signs, but that's okay. They have a deal that they can still make margins on. And I get it. Their construction budget's going to be a little bit light because they don't realize their contractor is going to steal from them at some point. And then they got to find a new contractor. So like, but like, and these are things that like I'll have a conversation with them and I'm like, this is what's going to happen in reality, but that's okay. There's still enough margin for you, but they're willing to put in money. They're willing to put in time. And like the way I look at it is, if you're a killer in your current, in like your W-2 job, or if you're a killer in something else, you're gonna be a killer in real estate investing. It's the same mindset. It's the same setup. And if you're a schlep in something else, you'll probably be a schlep in this. So like, I love working with borrowers like that, mostly because like they're easy for us to capture because the institutional capital won't touch them, which is crazy.
And you can buy their loyalty because you're the person that's
absolutely 100% accurate.
Yeah,
100%. But it's funny because that's like the first thing, be like, oh, hey, I'm calling around and, you know, so-and-so won't give me money because I haven't done 3 flips. And I'm like, tell me a little bit about yourself. And like, that's character, right? Like forget collateral at that point. Let's just talk about your character. And it's like, oh, well, you know, I've had this job for 10 years, make $160,000. I'm whatever. I'm a professional title. You know, I went through this program. It's like, great, let's do it. Like, I can almost promise that they're going to succeed. And if they don't succeed on the lender side, they're going to make us whole.
Nah, I think that's a, it's very, I commend you for doing that, because a lot of people, they just need a leg up and they need somebody to take a chance on them. And I think if they're a good judge of character with, I think there's a lot of good people out there. They can really do some damage in the future and create the life they want. And, Because I see is that we see ourselves in them.
Yeah.
You see yourself in them because you knew what it take to get started. So when you see somebody come around that has good character, they have a will to, and gumption to succeed, and they just need a little bit of help.
Yeah. And they're not expecting you to like hold their, like they're not expecting, like a lot of people just have like, what's the word? Like they're just having expectations like, oh, you should just do all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, no, you should do all this stuff and you should want to learn to do this stuff and you can do it. And you can usually tell pretty quickly by the way that they communicate via email or phone call, like very quickly, you know how they are and how they're going to perform. I mean, we've done 3,500 plus loans in the last 16, 17 years and, you know, serviced them all. And a lot of them have construction components. And I mean, I've talked to tens of thousands, maybe even 100,000 prospects. So like, you know, firsthand. So like, we always joke about it internally. Like we almost know to a T the path that every one of our loans is going to go, pretty much exactly how it's going to go. And some of them have speed bumps. You know, we'll do loans, you know, for real estate, for real estate investors that, you know, are not A plus, like, you know, they've got bumps and bruises and, you know, maybe lower credit, maybe this, maybe that, maybe they failed on a construction project and, you know, we'll be more cautious, but like, you know, we don't, it's funny because someone will be like, hey, if, you know, can I pay more to get higher leverage? You know, instead of 3 points, can I pay 4 points to get higher leverage? Or, and I'm like, our risk isn't, we're not a bank. Like your risk isn't based on, hey, if I make an extra few thousand bucks, our risk is based on exposure, and loan, LT, you know, loan to value. So if a borrower is riskier, let's just call it, we're just going to lend them less money.
Yeah. They have to put more down.
Yeah. And we'll make it up that way.
Yeah. That, one thing I love about like the lending game and the paper game is you can make the numbers work.
That's right.
For anybody, pretty much anybody, as long as they fit their, I think your 4 points, you kind of dive in. It's like,
yeah,
you make it work for anybody.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of had this thing internally that we don't turn down anybody. Like we just adjust based on where we're comfortable with. No. And hey, you might buy a property for $1 million. We might only give you 10 grand on it, but you know, like it might not be that extreme, but most of the time that's kind of where it's at, is we're just going to adjust based on risk. But over the last, you know, few years, we've also realized that character is such a big play. And if they're just going to be a pain in the neck, like it's just, it's a partnership, right? Like I can't deal with it. Like our time is better used elsewhere. Like I don't like some people just make the wrong decisions. Like some people have bad luck in life and they make the wrong decisions and I don't know why, but like, it's like that. I mean, we've had a friend and you know, real estate colleague before that just everything touched, just made the bad decisions about it. I don't know why that was. And like, he just like, it wasn't like he was a bad person or his intent was that, but yeah, like, you know, he'd reach out to us and like pick our brain about something. And he's like, yeah, I was thinking about doing this. I was like, why? Like, that doesn't make sense. Well, I could do this. I'm like, just sell the property. You know, you're gonna make $30,000 today, or you're gonna do all this work and heavy lifting to hopefully make $40,000, you know, in 6 months from now, hopefully. And that's if everything works out perfectly. So like, I don't know. Some people see it, I guess. Some people might not, or you learn that as well, like over time.
I think, and this is my point of view based off of that type of person. I think they're on that path, and some people are shortcutted based off of what they know and experience and their individuality. But some people, they need to trip and fall for a long time. And eventually they see it down the road. Like, and I don't know how long that road is. It's different for every person. Yep. So that road can go for years in timeline wise, but I think I have hope that everybody eventually hits their goal down the line.
Yeah,
I can't protect that.
One of our offices early on, like this is an office we opened 10 years ago with one of our partners, and early on we had a default that was somewhat of a bad default, and in essence we could have continued to throw good money at bad money. Or we were just like, let's just take this loss and just roll out. Like, there's too much stuff. But like, that hit him hard. And he was like, I did a deal and I'm like losing personal money on this. It was a small amount of money, but it was still like, you know, you're not expected, like, hey, we get in business, you know, we're a for-profit business. You know, you don't ever want to lose money on a transaction. Yeah. But like, you know, it hit him hard and he's been cautious ever since, you know, just because like that's what woke him up, you know, woke him up or hit him. So have you ever read the book, The Psychology of Money?
No,
I recommend that to all your listeners. It's so good. And there's a guy named Morgan Housel. He just actually came out with a new book that I'm reading right now. It's called Same as Ever. But like, The Psychology of Money is, I mean, it's amazing because it's like, you know, you go by your past experiences. Like, we're both going to look at a deal differently just based on, you know, our goals, you know, moving forward and our experiences from the past. And that's just what. And that's how it is. And I don't know, psychology of money just ties, you know, it sums up everything, you know, how you look at a dollar, how you look at money, how you look at everything that, and it's like, you can't even like, my takeaways wouldn't be relevant to you and your takeaways wouldn't be relevant to me.
Yeah.
But it, you know, there's like sub stories about like why people win why people play the lottery, because like a lot of like rich people know that the odds are stupid. And you'll never win the lottery, so they don't play. They know it's a waste of money. But a lot of poor people play the lottery because they don't see a path to ever becoming a millionaire. It's not conceivable to them. So yeah. This is the one path that they can play, that there is a possibility, even though it's very, very slim. So like, it's just filled of like amazing stories like that. So I definitely recommend that book.
Yeah, I think that equates to like people putting their kids through sports because they feel like that's the only way to succeed. And they drive down on sports because the only way you're going to make it out of this neighborhood is if you become the best baseball/basketball player out there.
Same as win the lottery, the numbers.
I totally agree with that. It's so crazy to me. It's so crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, the ones at that level, I mean, I'm a big advocate for youth sports. You're not necessarily unrealistic about actually professional or even playing at a collegiate level, but I get those are small chances, but like there is, I do love the, you know, the sportsmanship, you know, being a part of a team, a community, brotherhood, sisterhood. Like, I think that is super, you know, super important if that's something if a kid's into that.
Kids that play sports become really good entrepreneurs.
I think you're right. I think that makes sense.
So
I mean, a winner is a winner. Like, that's not like a means thing to say. Like, yeah. You know, I've got, you know, we have friends and people in our sphere that are professional athletes at the highest level. And like, I'm like, you can do whatever you want. You're retired. You know, you're a retired football player. You know, it's like, just do whatever you want. Like, you'll be successful. Like, you put in the 10,000 hours that you put into that. Like, you will be successful. You have it. It's just a matter of like what you want to do.
Are you guys set up as like a fund structure?
We're not. The way that we do all of our loans, and you know, at our size and our capacity, like you might think it's silly. It's just the way we've always done it, is more like a direct placement model. So like, okay, we'll close a loan for $100,000, and then we'll have a co-lending agreement with, you know, Jim Smith, and he'll buy the $100,000 note with us. And then we'll retain the servicing. So everything closes under our name and we keep it that way. But like, you know, some people call it direct placement. A lot of like inside private hard money lending companies call it like Tetris. Cause if you feel like you're always playing Tetris, it's like, okay, cool. I got $1 million here and I got $1 million of loans coming out. What capital's going into what? But honestly, it's the only way we know. We know it. It's what we've done for 16 or 17 years. And at this point, it's actually very, very easy. Like, it just is. I mean, it's, you know, and I know you mentioned, you know, we could talk about capital today compared to yesterday, you know, in the past, you know, in the future, you know, how it is raising it now compared to the past. But like now, like the capital just raises itself, and having that capital availability now, and, you know, having the same investors, you know, for a long period of time that are, you know, investing and co-lending and deals with us, it makes life easy.
Yeah. No, I've never heard of somebody doing like direct placement. And depending on your volume, I would assume that's a big game of Tetris.
Yeah, it can be. What state are you in again?
I live in California, but we do a lot of stuff in Texas.
Yeah. So I don't know if you can do it like this in California or not. I know California is obviously a lot more regular. I don't lend in California. There's a lot more regulations, lender license, broker license, probably servicing license. Mm-hmm. I do know a few lenders, and I think they might have it set up like that, but I'm not 100% sure. So in essence, it's like a co-lending. Yeah. But it might sound sophisticated. It might sound like it's labor intensive, but there's pros and cons. I mean, so here's the thing. Like, if there's pros and cons of a fund, right? The obviously the pro of a fund is, let's say you have 100 deals outstanding, you know, you're part of all those 100 deals. And if one deal goes bad, it's not really going to change any effect on the return because you're diversified into them.
Yep.
Bad thing is you don't really have control over anything that's going into that fund or have anything related to the deal. When we started out, it was kind of like a broker setup where it's like, you have $100,000. I don't have any money. I have a good deal. I will broker it to you, and then I'll retain servicing for it. So we'll broker it to you. You wire the $100,000 in, and then we'll retain the servicing, and we collect the payments and make sure tax insurance. And then it's become obviously a little bit more robust and sophisticated since then.
Yeah.
But it kind of stemmed from that.
Gotcha. No, it's cool, man. I'm very intrigued how it works in the back end. I'm very, very intrigued because I think it's having a lot of capital, the capital stack on your fund, on your money side, you have to kind of align all that stuff whenever.
Absolutely.
And I think it's cool. It's very cool. What is a quote that is yours or somebody else's that you resonate with?
That's a good question. And I used to have that quote on my wall until there was fire damage in the office above us and the sprinkler systems came on. And when the fire department came in, that was part of the stuff that they cleaned up. So I don't exactly remember what it was, but it was something like this. It was a Warren Buffett quote that I got off the book Snowball.
Okay.
And in essence, it was similar. I'm just going to paraphrase it because I don't really remember exactly how it goes, but it was, I'm always looking for a business venture that can continue to deploy my own capital or company capital at very high rates of return and continue to do that over and over and over. This is a hard operation or company to find, but if you find one, go all in with it, something like that. And that's in essence what a hard money company can do. You can deploy money at, you know, high interest rates of return or higher than stock market or average rates of return, but you just got to have to keep feeding the machine and finding good deals over and over and over to do so. And I completely butchered that term, obviously.
I'm going to find that quote because I think
I can find it. I have it somewhere because have you ever read that book, The Snowball by Warren Buffett?
I'm not a big reader. I'm really not.
Audible. I don't know how to read. I know how to listen to audiobooks.
I don't know how to read either.
my reading's very challenging. I've read very little physical books, maybe never finished one. But I listen to a lot of audiobooks. And maybe like 4 years ago, I started heavy on that. So I usually can do like two books a month at this point, all on audio. And as you start listening to books, you know, I walk around my neighborhood in the morning. In essence, I just wander because I'm like ingrained in a book. But like some people drive and listen to books wherever you can like absorb it. But I mean, I can bang out, you know, 45 minutes or an hour a day. And, you know, every 2 weeks that gets you through a book. And it goes a long way. You learn, that's been a big thing for me.
I'm going to have to try that because the last book I read, I got the audiobook and I got the physical version. So I'm kind of like skimming while I was reading it.
Yeah, that's what people say to do.
So I did that. I did that in the last book I read, to try to get like the best of both worlds. But
here's the thing. If it's something you're interested in, it's easy. If it's something you're not interested in, or if the book doesn't work, start with Psychology and Money. I promise you. Buy Psychology of Money on Audible. if you can't get into that book, like you just lose interest, maybe reading's not for you. No. But I think you'll like the reason why, it's just there's a lot of storytelling. You know, I heard this. I wrote down this quote. It wasn't a quote, but like something that I heard somebody say in an interview the other day. And I mean, I do a bunch of podcasts and I do a lot of content online, and like people don't want to be lectured to, they want to be told stories. And like, that's how you learn, right? I mean, I could tell you how to flip a house and the mechanics of all this in 10 minutes, or I could just kind of story tell you of like, hey, this is how we did this deal. This is what I did to find that, you know, and then you turn it into a story and then people are engaged. And you know, that's also sales, right? Storytelling compared to lecturing. So I like biographies. I like stories. Like that's easy. That's easy to listen to and absorb.
Gotcha. You have two podcasts that you do. Can you give us a little bit about those and where people can find those?
So I have two podcasts for two completely, totally different audiences. I have Private Lenders Podcast which I do with my business partner, Chris Haddon at Hard Money Bankers, where in essence, we help other private and hard money lenders throughout the country grow their hard money lending operation. You know, there's in essence two types of folks in that business, or in that we have a mastermind group called the Hard Money Mastermind as well. That's related to that, but a lot of them are just folks that have their own capital and they're trying to just responsibly deploy it into their own deals and learn how to do that. The other side of it are lenders kind of like us, that they have their own money and they raise capital and they're trying to scale into a bigger hard money operation. And then I also have the Real Estate Reserve Podcast that my friend Ian Horowitz and I host, and that's geared towards real estate investors. And we talk about single family real estate. We talk about self-storage real estate. We talk about commercial real estate, multifamily real estate, anything kind of real estate investment focused. And that's a fun one. I do them both weekly.
Okay. All right. Amazing. Amazing. I think this has been an amazing episode. I appreciate your time coming on, Jason. And
absolutely.
If you want to be a hard money lender, go check out this podcast. I think it's a great resource. And I think a lot of people, they can create a better ROI if they actively invest themselves.
No doubt. No, I agree. I mean, if you're investing yourself actively, I mean, you should be making, you know, 100 plus percent on your capital, like very, very high. You know, that's a big difference between passive and active. If you're a passive investor, you should be able to achieve, you know, 8-10%, maybe 12%, give or take, depending on your deal. But as an active investor, you should be, you know, hitting that out of the park.
Out of the park. 100%. I agree with that. 100%. So for everybody here, go like, share, subscribe. Thank you for coming.
Hey, if you have any deals you'd like to submit to the Hivemind and our team, go to hivebc.io. It's actually the Hive Buyers Club. Submit your deals and we can helpfully dispo your deal for you. Have a great day.